The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's program, we have all the news from this year's E3 gaming conference in Los Angeles. Bringing nearly 50,000 exhibitors, industry analysts, journalists to the LA Convention Center, E3, or the Electronic Entertainment Expo, is the biggest event in the gaming world's calendar, a massive showcase of the industry's upcoming titles and the latest global trends in gaming. And of course, the Guardian Games team was there. It's a jam-packed program, including Jonathan Ross, who tells us what he thinks is the future of gaming, Greg Goodrich, executive producer of Medal of Honor at Electronic Arts. He talks about the new Medal of Honor installment, Warfighter. And Andrew House, president of Sony Computer Entertainment. He talks about Sony's Wonderbook. In the studio today, I'm joined by the Guardian's Games team. Hello, boys.
Hello.
Hello.
Simon Parkin.
Hi there.
Hello. And Keith Stewart.
Hello.
Hiya. Welcome to the podcast. How was Los Angeles, Keith?
It was really, really tiring and exhausting and an entire mental onslaught.
It sounds like E3.
Yeah.
Did you see any of the outside world at all? Any palm trees? Any beautiful things at all, Simon?
Yes, I mean, we were staying in downtown, which is where the actual conference takes place, and in the evenings kind of did some trips to Sunset Strip and places like that.
Of course, you actually have to leave. You have to get in a car.
And pay all of the dollars to get.
Yeah, there is a lot of dollars to pay.
I mean, LA's so big, so yeah.
Massive.
It takes a while to get around.
Absolutely massive. And
Santa Monica's lovely as well. That's kind of a little bit of civilization within the nightmare of LA.
It is enormous. It's just absolutely expensive. But apparently, and this is a very Guardian thing to say, they now have rental bikes. So like Boris bikes here, or, you know, TFL cycles, as they prefer to be called.
Do they have a tandem? Could me and Simon pedal?
You could probably, one person could sit in the front. You could do a back.
In a back.
And a fronty.
That would be great.
That would be hilarious.
Do the entire vlog riding around LA.
Miles and miles and miles and miles and miles.
We could ride it straight into the exhibition centre and ride around.
Or straight into the water, into the ocean.
We do that at the end as a sort of tragic finale.
Oh, no. I'm just, you know, briefly. You know, you can ride it in and then ride it back out again.
In my head, this is a bit like Brokeback Mountain.
And you can get all this and more on the Guardian's Games blog.
No one was expecting that.
Absolutely not. But hey, I'm really glad it happened. Anyway, people, hold on to your hats and keep listening to the next 30 or so minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Jonathan Ross, the comedian, is a well-known longtime gamer and a fan of E3, so it was no surprise when he was caught by The Guardian's Stuart O'Connor at the event. Here, first, he gives us his impressions about the future and where the big boys have gone wrong.
Looking at mainly the big three is that they all seem to be ignoring social and kind of mobile games this year. And that's weird, because I think that clearly is the market at the moment. Smartphones these days, that's the way forward. People are playing on their phones. Do you really want to lug around something else with another charger and separate games that aren't even loaded on it? You know, I don't think people do anymore. I think they're being a bit ostrich-like there, you know, putting their heads in the sand and ignoring the reality out there, which is that Twitter's huge, Facebook is huge, all the existing, you know, Tumblr's huge, all these things that especially kids use now without even thinking twice. That's kind of what you want integrated into your gameplay if you want to have a kind of the whole picture. Let's face it, it's like a seismic change that's occurred around gaming this year. I mean, I wouldn't want to be in the hardware business anymore. You know, I'd want to be developing because, you know, it's too tough. You've got to get people to pick up a brand new console and brand new games. Like, in the current, you know, economic climate, it's not an easy sell, I don't think.
So, Simon, Jonathan there is talking about how the future is integrating social networks, social media into games, because that's, as he says, where the kids are. Glad to say that I'm also on those networks, so I'm officially a kid. Thanks, Jonathan. Is he right?
Companies have been doing this for a couple of years now, I think. In was it Uncharted 2, you were able to kind of tweet that you just finished a level and stuff like that. And, you know, it's cute. the first time you see it, and then the second time it's not cute anymore.
And so
then,
has it just not been integrated in a clever and successful way, or is it, or is this just, you know, nope, didn't work?
I'm not sure how you can elegantly do it, other than saying, I just completed this part of a game, or this is my high score, which basically every iOS game does now. And I think people are already kind of bored of that, and it's oversaturated. So I don't know. They're kind of, for me, they're two different things. I use Facebook in a particular way. I use Twitter in a very different way. I use Tumblr in a very different way. And I play games in, like, a box over here.
You're one of the kids he's referring to as well.
I think... What he says is slightly wrong. You know, I think the future of
Jonathan. This isn't Simon.
No, not Simon. Of course. And I think that really the future with social integration in games is specialized in-game social hubs and services like Need for Speed Hot Pursuit introduced this idea of the autolog, in which gamers, when you finish a race, your high speed is then shown to all your friends on Xbox Live, so then they can try and race against it and beat it. And you get the same thing in Battlefield and in Call of Duty as well. Have this same idea of they're calling it asynchronous multiplayer, which is this idea of being able to compete against your friends within a game. Go onto Xbox Live or PlayStation Network and see what their scores are and what they've achieved, and then you can play against that and beat it. So that's,
it's like
kind
old school leaderboards, basically.
Exactly, yeah. So I mean, that's a game specific integration of social networking,
but
that actually works.
I remember Zay Frank bringing some really interesting ways of making these types of social media systems playable, as it were. So is it not perhaps just taking a different perspective on the gaming element, and rather than trying to integrate these things into pre-existing games or pre-existing game mechanics, taking the game mechanics perhaps and applying them to these different places?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, as Simon said, just taking raw data and shoving it onto social networks isn't the way of doing it, and neither really is making games work specifically on social networks. So sometimes that works. We've seen really good Sims social works kind of well. It works within the confines and the parameters of a social network. But I think the way ahead is definitely taking the principles of social networking and applying them to specific games in the way that they work for those specific titles, so that you get a sense you're always competing against your friends and communicate with your friends, even if they're not online at the same time as you.
Speaking of Sims Social, Keith, we were talking before about SimCity was announced for Facebook.
Yes. They're bringing out, EA and the developer Maxis are bringing out a full PC version of a new version of SimCity. But yeah, they're also doing a social version for Facebook. And I think what they're going to do is the same as what they did with The Sims, which was simplify the interface, reduce the simulation layer a little bit, and make something that you can have fun with friends. You can, I suspect, what they're looking to provide is a more robust take on the Cityville, on Zynga's Cityville. In fact, they actually cheekily referenced Cityville in their conference. They said that their game is going to be more city than ville.
So,
I'm not exactly sure what that meant, but
it's in the trailer as well, haven't they? They have a sign that's kind of broken in two, and it just has the Ville bit, and then it collapses, and then they kick into their trailer.
Ooh,
so
handbags.
Yeah, they definitely
get them with their EA Zynga.
This is weird, isn't it? This is creeping back into the games industry. I mean, this is how it used to be in the 90s.
Yes, I remember.
Especially with EA and Activision, you know, what they went through last year with Battlefield versus Modern Warfare 3. There is a lot of handbags and disses and things.
Well, before we get too deeply involved in the soap opera of the games industry, let's hear a little bit more from Jonathan Ross on what he particularly liked from E3.
Sony is still experimenting a little bit, not just with hardware. You know, there's the, I don't know if you saw any news about the that kind of enhanced book reading experience they're trying to be as a kind of add-on to the PlayStation, and that's an odd idea. I mean, that's an odd area for them to be going into, I think, because I don't think anyone thinks of Sony or the PlayStation as a place to go to for the reading experience.
Yeah, there's their Wonder Book, the Book of Spells, which they've done in conjunction with J.K. Rowling.
Well, that's the big selling point, obviously. They've got Rowling on board, and then the Potter kind of loyalty and awareness is enormous. So it was interesting as well to see games like that. There's an Assassin's Creed, a new Assassin's Creed game out that looks incredible. I played Ninja Gaiden 3 on it, which was incredibly bloody. Really nice to play on there. Really nice to use that controller. But again, though, it goes back to gameplay. You know, not the graphics, not the tech. It goes back to the gameplay itself. And I think the hit of, if we're talking about the Nintendo launch now, the hit of that was I was with my daughter and we played a number of them on this new thing called a Nintendo Land, which is a kind of an odd kind of fake theme park idea, a virtual theme park you go to where you can play specific mini games based on some of their biggest franchise characters. And the one that we really enjoyed was the one that didn't look like any game out there at the moment, and it certainly only kind of had a passing resemblance to the original game it was based on, which was a kind of a Donkey Kong, almost like puzzle roller coaster game, where you have to move flips and levers and also use the accelerometer to move your controller around to move this kind of tiny, quite fragile little cart around what looked a little bit like the climbing platform that Donkey Kong began on in day one. And she found that really addictive. She didn't want to put that down. And that's a game where you think that's a kind of incredibly simple idea that doesn't rely on great speed of computing. It doesn't rely on incredible graphics. It was just good old-fashioned gameplay.
All right, and you can be back at the show tomorrow?
We're going to be back for a while, but it's kind of exhausting. And the weird thing they do here, and this isn't a criticism as such, it's very much a first-world problem, but the thing they do here is, that, of course, at home we play games sitting down. Here, you're standing up the whole time, and you just realise how much more tiring the world would be if you had to play your video game standing up. You imagine you're playing something like Mass Effect, and you've got to stand for the whole game. You'd be standing for months. So I think maybe they might want to invest in some chairs next year. I don't know. Is that a radical thought?
That was Jonathan Ross with Stuart O'Connor. So, Simon, how was E3?
Well, the word on the street, and for me being there as well, was that it was a lacklustre E3. It was kind of one of the weaker ones in recent years. And I guess part of that is attributable to the fact that we're at the end of a console cycle. We've got the Wii U coming out at Christmas, and then next year everyone's expecting the announcements of Microsoft and Sony's new hardware.
Because there actually wasn't any hardware announcements at all this
year. There were no hardware announcements this year. But I think actually the bigger problem was there were very few new game announcements actually made at E3. Now, there were quite a few of those made the week before E3, with kind of E3 trailers leaking onto the internet, or I say leaking in inverted commas, deliberately.
Published on the internet by the publishers.
Yeah, exactly. So really, there were very few new games announced at E3. There was Watch Dogs from Ubisoft, which was probably the game that made the biggest amount of splash in terms of people's reactions. And then a game from Platinum for Wii U called Project P100 that was quite exciting. But other than those two, there were very few kind of big blockbusters announced at the show. And I think for that reason, it kind of maybe the balloon of hype and excitement that we normally expect from E3 kind of was deflated a bit.
Yeah, so, I mean, they almost deflated themselves now anyway, because everything, they tend to showcase everything before the event anyway. Plus, you know, there's game announcements throughout the year, there's Gamescom, there's other events. But I thought the ironic thing about this E3, though, is that although everyone was saying it's kind of lackluster, it was actually quite a good year for original IP. The biggest game, like Simon said, was Watch Dogs, this kind of science fiction, action adventure based around hacking into urban mainframes and controlling the urban system, which is very kind of zeitgeisty. Yeah, exactly. It's war games all over again. But there's also Sony's Last of Us, their post-apocalyptic action adventure was there. Beyond, the new game from David Cage and Quantic Dreams, who did Heavy Rain last year. So in some ways, it was a good year for new IP, but not a great year for showing off masses of new exciting hardware and new announcements.
So Simon, as Keith says, you know, there is now a panoply. There's a proliferation of games related events that happen throughout the year in various regions and various territories. You know, there's one happening in Brighton, for example, next month. There's the Develop Conference. Is E3? Well, okay, I'm going to caveat this by saying that I have a personal beef against E3. I've never liked it because of its flashiness and because it doesn't actually, I don't know, I've never felt that it actually engages with the games industry on an interesting level. It's just very much about pushing stuff in front of people's faces in the hopes of getting them to buy it. It's a business event. It's a trade event. Is it still relevant, though?
Well, I mean, I think going back to what I was saying about the lack of announcements at E3 made it feel less relevant than it perhaps has been in the past. I mean, if you contrast with Apple's big event last night, where there were no leaks ahead.
And that was the WWDC
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And I think because they remain so tight-lipped right up until the moment of the show, all eyes and focus is on the show and everyone's like, what's going to happen? This is really exciting. Everyone's kind of on the social networks at the same time. And there's a little bit of that around the big kind of hardware manufacturers' press briefings at E3. But to be honest, you know, we knew there was very little new, like, talked about at those. You know, we kind of, you know, we'd seen the hand before it happened. So I think for that reason, everyone kind of walked away feeling like,
Yeah, I think
One of the things, Keith, actually, that I that I'm curious about, given that there wasn't so much of an emphasis on the hardware, which often there is, and it's you know what the big hardware manufacturers are trying to pimp for their products, you know, for their consoles. Was there much of an indie presence, or was it sort of pushed to the side? Is it unfortunately?
It was kind of pushed aside. I mean, for the last couple of years, there is a kind of traveling indie festival in the US called Indiecade, who have had a presence at E3 for the last few years. For the last 2 years, that presence was in one of the main halls where all the big publishers are, and it was really cool actually, because you'd get the Activision stand, then right next to it you'd get this little bunch of indie developers with their little PCs and Coke cans and Red Bull cans everywhere, and it gave this different vibe to the room. But this year the Indiecade section was out on a concourse by itself, and it's actually quite difficult to find without a map, but they still had the same amount of people there. It was just very much partitioned, and which is a real shame, because I talked to a couple of Activision and EA executives last year, and they were saying, you know, they took the time to check out Indiecade and go and see the developers, but I'm not sure whether they would have got the chance this year because they were very much kind of sidelined. But there was a presence there, and all the big the bigger companies, Microsoft and Sony, both had an indie presence on their stands. Usually it would be digital download games for Xbox Live Arcade or PSN, but there were offbeat games there. There was a small British developer called Clever Beans on the PlayStation on Sony's European stand, who had a game called When Vikings Attack, which was this really lovely beat 'em up title where you control groups of people throwing stuff at Vikings, and it was just a really silly game. But a few months ago, that was just a demo that they were showing around companies. Sony saw it and loved it, and the next month they're on Sony's stand at E3.
Well, what about the different platforms then? What about things like smartphones or something that I keep hearing about from you guys and also from some of the audio that we've got on the program is smart glass. You know, what about that? Was there a presence there? Were there games for those technologies?
Well, yeah, smart glass was Microsoft's big kind of big technology announcement, and it's essentially an app which allows you to connect your smartphone to your Xbox account so that you can play games across Xbox and your mobile phone, and also have your mobile phone interconnecting with Xbox games.
Gosh, that sounds a bit like the Dreamcast, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it's very much
properly old school, aren't it?
Yeah. I didn't think I'd ever hear that name.
Joy of VMU.
I will say as often as I possibly can, it's most innovative console ever.
It's very much Microsoft's answer to the VMU. it's actually Microsoft attempting to attack Nintendo's Wii U and also the whole idea of Apple TV and Google TV. Everyone wants to capture this figurative space in the living room, this idea of dual screens, and the fact we're all sitting there with tablets and our laps watching television and tweeting everything. Games very want to capture that vibe, and that's what Wii U's about with its tablet controller. Microsoft, I think, saw that announcement last year, thought, holy crap, this is where technology is going, let's think of something similar. And they've come up with this smart glass technology.
Simon, do you think it's going to be effective? Do you think it's going to manage to capture people's imaginations so that they can, you know, they can continue to play their games at the bus stops as we dreamt of when we had those little VMUs?
Well, I think the primary use of it will be in a kind of dual screen Wii U style game setup. So the kind of during the announcement, they showed how in Halo 4, you'll be able to look down at, say, your iPad and read some extra information on your guns and things like that. And then look back up.
Too busy shooting people, frankly.
Yeah, which, you know, is, I think it's one of those things that you're like, oh, wow, that's neat. And then you turn your iPad off and because, you know, yeah, you don't care about what your data is on your assault rifle. You just want to shoot the alien, right? So its success will come down to the application that developers can find for it, I think. And if they can find interesting ways to integrate a second screen, then, yeah. And I imagine they'll take the Nintendo's lead here. So they'll look at how kind of Nintendo EAD integrating their Wii U controller into some of their games. And I'm sure we'll see lots of kind of copycat work going on in the next 18 months.
Well, and we will, of course, be following this at guardian.co.uk/games, where you can also see all of the E3 coverage. But we're not done. Oh, no, not at all. It wasn't just platform holders who held sway at this year's event, obviously. Electronic Arts, the world's largest publisher, was pimping its bestsellers. Now, Keith, you spoke with the EA team. What did they have on offer?
They had their usual roster of games. They had FIFA there. They had the new NBA and NFL games.
Hold on a minute. FIFA what now?
I mean, FIFA 13, FIFA. Alex.
Jeez,
keep up.
I swear, I remember Emily Newton-Dunn.
It's got new AI.
I know. She was doing the very, 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 very first pilot episode of Bits, this television program on Channel 4 many moons ago. And she was talking about FIFA in 99. Like, that's like, it's just stopped in my head at this point. 13!
Still going.
Dear
yeah.
God, don't they have any other ideas?
They don't need to. This thing sells 6-7 million copies a time. Why should they have
Of course, of course, of course, yes. Anyway, what else do they
just
have?
Just leave it. yeah, as well as FIFA, they had Crysis 3, another new shooter. They had Need for Speed Most Wanted, a open world driving game, which looks quite nice, by the Guildford-based Criterion Studio. And they had their answer, this year's answer, to the Black Ops, Call of Duty Black Ops game, which is a Medal of Honor Warfighter.
So, Keith, you spoke with Greg Goodrich, who's the exec producer of Medal of Honor, and what did he have to say?
He was talking very much about the fact that this game is not only based on real-world conflicts around the world, he also wants to convey the emotional realism of war. And I don't know really how that's going to work out. I mean, there's lots of... I think they've obviously watched things like Hurt Locker, and they've talked to Tier 1 operators, the people that are in the Navy SEALs and the SAS. They have a lot of people that advise them on this game. And they've said one of the things that keeps coming up is this kind of emotional side of it. They're human beings, and they miss their wives, and they miss their children. And they're trying to get this angle into the game. And people are quite skeptical about this, and I can see why, because... You know, shooting games are essentially about shooting, and trying to wedge in any kind of other emotional context is quite difficult. But Greg, as I said, you know, at their studio, they actually have an in-house, their associate producer used to be a Tier 1 operator. He was a Navy SEAL, and I think he's given them lots of ideas about the reality of these situations and how they work.
So let's hear what he has to say.
So as you know, with Medal of Honor, we take a different tone, and we always have. You know, the franchise was created by Steven Spielberg in 1998 as the game version of Saving Private Ryan. And when he created the franchise, you know, and actually when we created that film, it was a big thank you letter to his dad and the Greatest Generation. And so when we reboot the franchise and brought it into the modern times, we went back to those core tenets of honor, respect, a real reverence for the material. And quite frankly, we just want to say thank you to the servicemen and women around the world and pay tribute to that sacrifice. In Warfighter, in the single-player narrative, we're focusing on those same operators, but it's more of what they fight for back home. It's a very deep, rich story of not only the sacrifices the guys are making, but the families are making as well. You know, the wives and kids who, you know, these guys are deployed 300 days out of the year. When they're not deployed, they're training, and so... you know, that takes a toll.
That was EA's Greg Goodrich speaking with Keith. Simon, emotional depth in games, that's something that I've heard for a while. Are we actually anywhere near it now?
Oh, no. So far off. I mean, you know, one of the frustrating things is that with this example here with Medal of Honor, I think trying to add in the emotional depth into blockbuster games always seems to be kind of... developers are trying to achieve it through the cutscenes, which is very much a kind of cinematic...
You just click straight through them, don't you?
Yeah. So, but I mean, it's never really on a mechanical, systemic level with games at the moment. Still, kind of the new Medal of Honor is about shooting kind of enemies in the face mechanically, you know, before they shoot you. It's Space Invaders, really. And then they're like, well, you know, well, let's have some cinematics on top to make you, you know, show the phone call home to the wife and all of that kind of thing. And then, oh, yeah, now we have emotional depth. I don't think it really works like that.
Keith, what's missing from the emotional depth? I mean, if you are playing Space Invaders, you know, if you are shooting people, how can you import emotional depth into something like this? We've seen it in other games. We've seen, for example, in Ico, is something that people talk about a lot. They talk about Final Fantasy and how that made them cry. So it is possible.
Yeah.
Is it essential in every game?
No, it's not essential in every game, obviously. You're never going to have emotional depth in Tetris or any other
puzzle game. I don't know, tension. Tension is an yeah. emotion, and I have tension when I'm playing Tetris.
Those bloody L blocks.
I like the little, yeah, exactly, falling in love.
Anyway. Yeah, yeah. I think the problem is, as Simon said, that the emotion is hardly ever systemic. It's hardly ever part of the interactive action, and that's what has to happen, along with the fact that people have got to stop placing... basing games around getting headshots and blowing people's faces off, if you can get away from that. And I think one example, and this is a very controversial game, but Heavy Rain, I think for me, even though the central gameplay mechanic was quite clunky, it still built emotion into the experience. You were playing this father whose son had been kidnapped, and you had to go through a series of tests set for you by a serial killer in order to get your son back. And there were certain moments in that. There was a moment where the serial killer made Ethan, the father, go to a drug dealer's house, and he told him to shoot the drug dealer. And it was up to the gamer to try and decide, well, is that the right thing to do? Is that what my character would do? Could I do that in that situation? And actually making you think about shooting rather than just doing it and then having a cutscene later. That, for me, was as a kind of a benchmark that maybe games designers should be aiming towards, this idea of actually getting you to... consider your interactive responses and make feedback loops in games that aren't simply around pulling a trigger, then looking at the cutscene afterwards.
Now, Simon, I was on an airplane yesterday and I had a really long flight, to the extent that I actually started watching a movie that I should not have. It was called 21 Jump Street. Dear Lord, it was terrible. It stopped me. I literally turned it off within, I don't know, 15 minutes. I gave it that much time. But it's a classic example of a film that doesn't need necessarily to have any depth. It doesn't need to do anything because it speaks to a particular audience. It speaks to a particular reason why people will watch a film. Complete and utter escapism. It's not necessary, then, that you need to import some kind of emotional investment in every game. So is what Keith is suggesting, that we force gamers, that we force players to actually make these decisions, to actually consider these decisions when you're, you know, when you're out there and you're in your virtual Medal of Honor thing and you're shooting a dude over there, that you actually think about the fact that, you know, the person on the other side also has a wife and kids, mm-hmm. or a husband and kids, and they need to phone home, and, you know, do we need to think about that?
No, I mean, not every game needs to do that, but the big problem is that the thematic range of video games is so narrow at the moment. I mean, if you look at cinema, yes, you have films like the one you've referenced that may be very shallow and are performing a particular function.
Yes.
But we also have all kinds of other movies that kind of hit on other emotions and make us think and view the world in different ways. Whereas with games, the vast majority of experiences are kind of just mining one particular small area of creative soil. And I think that was one of the big frustrations at E3. Just looking at blockbusters and going, you don't have anything to say, like, really. And, you know, you reference Ico there, which, you know, is the game where you play as a young kind of boy helping a kind of waif-like princess out of a castle. Now, on a kind of mechanical level, that game's really interesting because you've got some custody of a character that's weaker than yourself. So you've got some ownership over that character, but also you need her to help you make your way to the end of the game. So on a kind of mechanical level, that's already quite emotive and interesting. And that's the only example we can think of, is that like 10 years old, that game almost. So, you know, I think that's the frustration with some critics, and also is increasingly with consumers, is on this particular issue that I think is one of the largest facing the games industry right now, if we're looking for a bit more maturity. And yeah, we've got to find some things to say.
Keith, just briefly, I Chris Crawford, who is a games designer and a games theorist, used to talk about verbs of games, because that's actually all it is. You need to figure out what it is that you do when you're designing a game. It's a verb-based thing. And to emotion is not...
To emote,
yes, perhaps is a verb. But to have an emotion, to be emotive, to emote, to emotion, is not really a verb that's often used in the games industry. Is it perhaps that we as consumers and game developers in general need to stop thinking about verbs and start thinking about different aspects of interactivity?
I think the mere existence of interactivity means that you have to think in as verbs, but you can vary the verbs. At the moment, as Simon says, emotional responses to games are effectively rage and exhilaration. And there is a wider vocabulary that we can be, that games can discuss and explore. And the fact that ICO does kind of still stand by itself is a really kind of bizarre indictment of games. Although there's lots of interesting games coming from the indie sector that do more to analyse emotion and discuss different things, and are doing what cinema is doing, which is giving us love stories and comedies and horror, whereas games just give us anger, aggression and rage.
And the occasional punching in the air when you do something awesome that involves...
That never happens to me.
Well, you're not playing the right games. Anyway, you can find out more about Medal of Honor, about the interview that Keith did with Greg Goodrich, and also about the indie games scene over at guardian.co.uk/games. We have heard from Nintendo, we've heard from EA, but what about PlayStation's daddy, Sony? Keith, they've had a troubled few years. What's happened to Sony?
They have had a troubled few years because they accidentally released an astonishingly complex and delayed piece of hardware called PlayStation 3, and also wider consumer electronics side, the sales of big screen TVs have collapsed, or the profit margin has anyway. So Sony has suffered both on the technology side of its business and also in the consumer electronics side of its business.
Then they released all of our credit card details.
And then they did, yes.
To the world.
To anonymous.
And then,
yeah, just the tip, just the icing on the downfall cake.
Dang.
They did that.
Dang. But, well, this sounds awfully like another piece of hardware company that seems to be struggling at the minute, which is RIM.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. And they've launched their PlayStation Vita handheld console into a market obviously dominated by smartphones. And although it has had some great games, I do not think it's going to make any kind of impact in the market, apart from being a sort of hardcore gamer's plaything. I don't know, Simon, if you agree.
No, I agree. I mean, it's an endlessly lavish piece of kit designed by the guy that designed the Walkman, but he appears to have stayed abreast of technology, and it's
that's
like
a
an
bit
interesting
of a relief.
Yeah, it's a contemporary, it's an amazing piece of kit. The screen looks fantastic. It's got dual, it's the first handheld to have two dual analog sticks, but at the same time it feels somehow like an anachronism. It doesn't quite feel relevant in some way, even
well,
though I kind of love it.
Cliff Richard writing a song about it. That's
well, Simon, do you think that they can come back as console kings, or do you think they should stick with software instead?
Well, who knows? I think next year's E3 is the one to watch, because that's when we're going to get the hardware announcements, and that's where I think the three kind of main hardware makers in the console business are going to distinguish themselves from one another, and we'll be able to see kind of what their clear direction is. This year it's quite difficult to tell where it's all heading, to be honest.
I was going to say, I spoke to the the head of Crytek, a very big game developer who developed the Crysis series, and he was saying that he believed this would be the last hardware generation, the one coming. He didn't believe there'd be another console hardware generation after this, because the way the industry is going, obviously, we all have smartphones, we all have tablets, we're going to have smart TVs in a few years with chipsets in them that was equally as powerful as consoles. There's a possibility that the dedicated games machine is just going to be shoved out of the pipeline.
Well, perhaps that's why they are diversifying. And Steve Boxer spoke with Andrew House, the head honcho at Sony, about the Wonderbook.
For me, it's there's something sort of a little bit magical about it in terms of, as I said on stage, you know, taking one of the oldest sort of, you know, information interfaces that we know, which is the book, and then somehow through, you know, the magic of brand new technology in AR, bringing that to life. I mean, I'm a big reader. I was a big reader as a kid, and I think there's something sort of childlike about, you know, fulfilling that dream of bringing books to life.
Yeah, you can see that it would be quite an easy sell to parents, because although it's for the PlayStation, it's sort of getting them into books.
Exactly, and you know, very frankly, Steve, that's why, you know, J.K. Rowling was enthusiastic about it. And she gave us some great pointers to the team in terms of you'll have seen people reacting with text and reading text and so on. And I think that's very important as part of its proposition. You know, it's magic, it's wonderful, there's a sense of play, but it is also a book. And I think there are obviously opportunities to try and, you know, you know, we get castigated an awful lot in you know, the interactive entertainment industry for, you know, a particular form of content, you know, or types of game that are very prominent. I think it's a great opportunity for us to show that, you know, interactive forms of entertainment can be taken in other directions as well.
That was The Guardian's Steve Boxer with Sony's Andrew House. And you can read more about The Guardian's E3 coverage at guardian.co.uk/games. That is it for this week's podcast. Many thanks to our studio guests, Simon Parkin.
Thank you.
Keith Stewart.
Thank you very much.
This is great. I've never really done that before. I might do it from now on.
I think it
no,
works
thank
out.
You. Thank you. Stuart O'Connor. No, he's downstairs. And Steve Boxer, elsewhere, who pounded the floor at LA Convention Center. We'll be back next week on Tuesday with the next episode of Tech Weekly, when Charles faces off with technology's enfant terrible, author and polemicist Andrew Keen. I'm Alex Kratosky. This week's podcast was produced by Simon Barnard. See all the links and everything else you could ever possibly imagine at guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.